Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, I have no comments today, so if you're really enjoying these programs, get some comments in here. Thank you for doing that. Now, last time, we continued our discussion of George and Martha Washington and their unique roles as America's first president and first lady. Now, today, I want to continue our discussion. And remember, George and Martha Washington had an incredible, insightful vision for American government and the culture of the presidency. But we also have to remember that they had to commit themselves to intense personal sacrifice to lay those foundations. Now, this is so important because so many of America's government leaders hold such a different view for American government and structure and the office of the presidency today. And really, Americans need to take some warning. This new vision for America is really going to lead to America's destruction. So now, to help me continue this discussion today, I have called back the 60-plus panel into action. And so, of course, that means it's myself and my wife. So, Deborah, welcome back.
Thank you.
And so I think we want to get back into Brady again today. And again, listeners, I do recommend that if you are so inclined and you want to read more about Martha Washington, get the book by Patricia Brady. It's titled Martha Washington, An American Life. And it really is, it's really a great companion to Johnson's book. And it just gives you both sides of a story. And it's really, I think it will just really complete your picture of the Washingtons. Now, let me just give you what Brady, how she summarizes the presidency in the first year. And this is the first year of his first term as president. And we'll talk about the second term, in just a few minutes. But if you remember, the Washingtons really didn't want to take the presidency first term anyway. And it really changed their whole lifestyle, and they really missed Mount Vernon. But let's just talk about this first year, here's what Brady has to say. It says, the first year of the presidency had seen an encouraging display of cooperation in nation building. And the nation wasn't built yet, but it was in the process. She continues, the next years were filled with rising controversy over just how the government was to operate. And as the president coped with dissensions among the men he trusted, the sad drama of his favorite nephew played itself out. And so remember, that's his nephew, George Augustine. And, he was having a lot of trouble with tuberculosis, and he was growing very sick. And I think one thing that we have to remember about the Washingtons is that their family life was critically important to them. And, they were very interested in the presidency. They were very interested in getting America off the ground, but they were also very interested in their own family. So Brady continues, it wasn't just a loss of someone he and Martha loved. Both of them worried about how Mount Vernon could continue to operate without an experienced farmer in charge. So they loved America. They loved the federal government, the idea of government. They loved what America could become, but they also loved Mount Vernon. And it really became a problem for them to kind of see it in decline and not have a good farmer there to take care of it. Now, I think it's also important that we begin to talk about the problems that began really in this in the presidency, but maybe not with the presidency as much as it was with getting the country up and running. Remember the First Continental Congress, the Constitution's been established, the structure of government was established, but now the problems were beginning. And so let's begin to talk about that, dear. What do you have to say about all of that? So,
well, it was interesting. I didn't really know about the differences between some of these founding fathers, but I can read what Patricia Brady says here. She says, whatever the general public might have thought in 1791 and subsequently, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had decided that the nation was in jeopardy from the machinations of Alexander Hamilton. So there was a difference between Jefferson and Hamilton, you know, right away.
Yes.
All his financial measures, this is Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of the Treasury, all his financial measures were leading down the gilded road to monarchy and damnation, according to Jefferson.
Yeah, let me just insert something here, is that just so everyone knows that Alexander Hamilton, what he was dealing with, he was trying to get America's credit position bigger so that America could start, functioning financially on the world scene. And so he was trying to increase, debt levels they could have and credit that they could have. And so Jefferson really began to have problems with what he was doing there. So now you go ahead.
Yes, and if you read what Johnson says, he talks a lot about how Hamilton really was very important and crucial in helping to get the country started. And Washington knew
financially,
it was really important to get the country started that way. But Jefferson had different political views.
Yes.
So Washington, in their developing view, was merely his dupe.
Right.
And James Madison agreed with Jefferson. Jefferson couldn't imagine that Washington seriously found Hamilton's plans better than his own for the nation. Although at this point, Jefferson had few concrete plans other than opposing Hamilton.
Right.
Jefferson took an extreme states' rights position, combating every attempt to strengthen the federal government, while the president was committed to creating a strongly united nation.
Right. And I think what's really kind of fascinating there is there were other people that didn't necessarily think Washington was the best man for president either. I mean, I think John Adams appreciated his virtue, but I don't think he was necessarily thought he'd make a good president. And again, the underlying reason for that is they're different political views, and so it's interesting. We'll talk a little bit later about how Martha saw the whole thing, but let's just go on now. Yep.
So not only was it the views in terms of the new government, but also foreign affairs too. I'm reading from Patricia Brady, were a crucial factor in the development of political parties. So the political parties are starting. Hamilton had fought the British bravely in the Revolution, but he still admired and wanted to emulate many British institutions. Jefferson had been in Paris when the Bastille fell in 1789 and was filled with enthusiasm and admiration for the French Revolution. Even as new rulers came and went, and the shadow of the guillotine loomed, he stood fast in his love for France and hatred for Great Britain. To Hamilton, all this was violence and anarchy that might engulf the United States. So I think that really is a clear distinction between the two, and how Jefferson was really the states' rights and revolution, is great and all that, whereas Hamilton was more of a strong central government is important, but someone like Jefferson, they were afraid of a monarchy, whereas Hamilton was afraid of anarchy. So you can see that.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting how liberal thinking is still the same today as it was then, and that's really the problem that we see in America today. I mean, again, it's like the Democratic Party. I don't even know if they understand exactly what they're doing. And I'm not a great politician. I haven't really studied a lot of politics, But all I know is there is a liberal element in this country that would really support the French Revolution. And then there's a conservative element in this country that would say we need a strong federal government. And right in the middle now we have President Trump. And again, you know, I don't want to get into politics, but, you know, on the positive side, President Trump has done some really good things for the country. And, of course, as even we talk about on the Trumpet Daily quite often, that everything he does to a certain group of people is considered wrong. And I think George Washington, years and years and years ago, saw the problem with two-party systems. And he saw the problems in thinking of people. And I think one of the things that he wanted to do most as president was to, you know, kind of have people grow up and realize that human nature isn't so great when it comes to politics. So, go ahead. Sorry.
I agree. I think that was something they didn't really expect, he and his wife, that the hostility that could get could come about in the politics, and it got worse. It also involved papers. It reminds me of today, you know, with the media. I mean, it was happening then, although in some ways it's worse now because we have electronic media. Then they had the newspapers, but they had newspapers on both sides, and they could get really kind of nasty. And that was something that really upset Martha, and it was hard for George Washington to take. And so I think that's interesting. So, because it looked like they both, Jefferson had someone, you know, supporting him, and then says Hamilton leapt to arms, publishing articles in his own defense in the other paper and skewering Jefferson. So it went back and forth.
Right.
And to Washington, this spirit of party was terribly upsetting. To try to bring the opponents together, he began holding formal cabinet meetings. Surely, talking face to face, they could get over their difficulties. He saw the issue as Northern versus Southern interest. He didn't yet realize that political parties had become a reality in the United States, with partisans committed to destroying the careers of their opponents. There would be no going back.
Yeah, and we're seeing it all play out today.
Yes.
I do think it's interesting that Brady brings out that everybody, I mean, Alexander Hamilton had his personal quirks. You know, I think that paragraph at the top of page 194 is really interesting. I mean, we are human beings. The people are people. And, you know, that doesn't destroy anybody's brilliance. But sometimes our personal quirks can get in the way. And here's what she says about Hamilton and Jefferson. It says, Alexander Hamilton was a brilliant man, but a terrible politician. Neurotic impulses often rule his behavior, and he suffered from the fatal delusion that he was a master manipulator, causing needless trust and dislike. Thomas Jefferson actually was a master manipulator, especially in combination with the detail-oriented James Madison. As Hamilton and Jefferson came to stand for coalescing political parties, they fought over matters of substance, but there was an underlying personal hostility as well. They hated each other, each considering the other a hypocrite with secret plans who was trying to use the president for his own ends, and they were both right. So it's just a common problem. This to me sounds like a Shakespeare play, you know, in the making. And so then, of course, like you said, they took it into the newspapers, and you know, that's when the real corruption begins. And, you know, you get people, then you stir up the troops, you stir up the people. And again, they were just getting started. I mean, this is like the second year of the new presidency. And so it's really too sad that some of these things were really beginning to happen. But that's the way it is with human nature. Notice what she says, what Brady says on page 195. Says Washington had enough of refereeing a progressively nastier game. Early in 1792, he informed Jefferson, Hamilton, Knox, and Madison that he would retire at the end of the term. The government was in working order, and he and his wife wanted to go home to enjoy the remainder of their lives. So what's the rest of the story?
Yes, unfortunately, they didn't get their wish. Yes. Yes, it says, when both Hamilton and Jefferson, as well as most other leaders, begged Washington to accept a second term, his sense of duty overcame his own desire for retirement. Martha was bitterly opposed to this decision and begged him to decline. She genuinely feared that her aging husband would not survive the presidency. His two close encounters with death and the partisan savagery among his cabinet members seemed reason enough for his retirement to a sensible woman. She was convinced that long hours, worry, emotional turmoil, and lack of regular country exercise were undermining his health. As far as she was concerned, her 60-year-old husband had done all he could be expected for his country.
Yeah, so it is kind of amazing to me that I think it just shows his virtue that he really wanted to return to Mount Vernon. I mean, they really wanted to get back to their life. I mean, they had a great life at Mount Vernon, and you know, you could just see how he could be discouraged, because he was not, let's say, a hostile kind of person. He could see the right way and just expect that everyone else could see it the right way, but that isn't the way it is in the world. I think all of us have had to learn that. And sometimes I've learned over the years, let's say, especially when I worked in business, when I worked for Westinghouse, if you came up with a good idea, there was another six people were jealous and they would shoot it down just because it was you and not them, you know. And so I think that's what Washington had to deal with. Well, it is kind of different how it all works. At the very end of that page 195, Brady says, it was almost unbearably disappointing to Martha when George again bowed to duty. He agreed to accept a second term if the vote was unanimous. And after a simple inauguration in the Senate chamber of March 4th, 1793, the torrents of the second term began, far crueler than anything she could have anticipated. So here we have the second term now. And I think it's interesting. I think we could talk about a few things here for the time we have left about some of the things that he fought in the second term. But I think one thing that we should say to kind of like introduce all this is that by the time George Washington hit his second term, America really had entered the world stage. I mean, it was not just the 13 little colonies under the protection of Britain anymore. It was now a new nation, you know. It was founded, and it really had some of the attention of the world. So, of course, one of the big problems, and Brady brings this out, is the French Revolution. You know, caused problems for America, and you know, we shouldn't be surprised by that, because if we know anything about the history, it was the French that came in and helped us win the American Revolutionary War. And so America had already made a tie to protect France. And so I think it's really, really quite interesting that, you know, that again, we alluded to this just a little bit ago, that here Hamilton loved Britain, and you know, Jefferson loved the French, you know. And of course, we know that Ben Franklin spent a lot of time with the French as well. Okay, so you have any comments on that, my friend?
Well, that was really tricky, because with the French Revolution, and then hearing that Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette had been, you know, guillotined, and then it was a new government, and there was a time when there were several different governments, and so it was tricky. What is their relationship? You know, because they had a treaty with the king, But now, is this treaty working with the new government or not?
Right.
And so that was a tricky part. And Washington felt they should be neutral. And that which that makes sense. It seems like a safe way of doing it. We should be neutral because at the same time, the French were also at war with England. And so it was getting pretty complicated. So the best thing would be to be neutral, whereas Jefferson didn't agree with that, but
right. Yes. I was just going to say, well, who are the two other parties in here that got their hands into the mix? And you know, Washington asked the question, you know, is this treaty still binding? And of course, Hamilton said no. Washington believed no, but who said yes? Thomas Jefferson. You know, so again, it's all personal political issues, and it may just make sense. I mean, if you really know anything about the French Revolution, I think sometime in the future we're going to have to do Tale of Two Cities on the radio just to get people interested in the French Revolution, because there's a lot you can learn from that, from studying the French Revolution. But the thing is even the leaders of the revolution, that the final government finally even killed them. I mean, Robespierre was killed. Jacobin, he was killed. You know, and then also, it really began to lead to kind of like world war on the continent there. You know, so the whole French Revolution, it just kept growing. And of course, I think George Washington wanted to keep America out of the fray. And it would only made sense. It was still, this is only his second term as president. And so America was still now beginning to have its own internal problems. And you know, America's now on the world stage, but it's the cabinet members, you know, that really were also a problem in this. And I think there's one thing about George Washington that, you know, even if we go back to the history of the Continental Congress, you know, and the, you know, the first and second one, and the whole idea behind the Constitution is, he really worked hard to keep his own opinions to himself, and he wanted to hear everybody's opinion. And in some ways, that style of his led to the fact that he'd be interested to hear what Jefferson had to say, and he would be interested to hear what Hamilton had to say, and then he would make a decision. But it kind of got out of control. And you know, as you said, he was really against a two-party system for that reason. But he was still very good at taking in the ideas of a lot of different people to come up with the right decision. And so that was the value of making him president. But then, you know, it's like any good leader, and when you're dealing with a government and building a government, you have to have also good leaders to support you, and you've got to be careful of characters like that. Like, again, Jefferson was a really smart man. Madison was smart. John Adams, they were all smart, but they all had their own different opinions. So it was just really difficult for him. And, of course, even Martha, you know, also suffered through some of that. So here's what Patricia Brady says about this issue. It says, Washington, this is on page 206, by the way, Washington grimly held on to his mission of establishing the government on firm foundations. First Knox and then Hamilton resigned their positions to attend to their own business affairs. What about his neglected acres? Rather than friends and innovators, his cabinet was composed of second-rate men. His pleasure in life now came largely from close friends and family, planning and sending instructions to Mount Vernon, and dreaming of retirement. The family returned to Philadelphia that fall without making their usual trip home during the congressional recess. And so the thing is, you know, the men that he started out with, eventually it's kind of like they all left him alone. And then his cabinet, you know, came to second-rate men. And, you know, how many second-rate men and women do we have in the government today? Well, we don't even want to begin to calculate the numbers for that. But anyway, it's just too bad that all of those things began to happen, but it really began to confirm his thinking was right. Okay, so one of the other things that was a problem for him was this whiskey insurrection, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that too, my love.
Well, there it had to do with in 1794, the excise tax on whiskey had been controversial since its imposition, because on the frontier, distilling grain into whiskey was the most efficient way of producing a commodity easily portable over trails and terrible roads. And people rebelled against this tax. Those accused of breaking the law would be tried in district courts far from their homes, an expensive journey, whatever the outcome of the trial. In the summer of 1794, farmers, distillers in western Pennsylvania rebelled against the tax and attacked tax collectors in what became known as the Whiskey Insurrection. Although encouraging changes in the law, Washington would not accept any defiance of federal authority. He believed that the nation's stability and future rested on respect for the law. So basically, he was tough, and he put together a large army, actually, to go and face the rebels. And actually, the rebels gave in without a battle because, you know, they were... The army came and faced them down, and they took the two leaders, and they were sentenced to death, but then later Washington pardoned them.
Right.
So it was the idea of showing force. One of the first times that the federal government showed force, that these are the laws. You know, we have to have law and order.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And the thing is, that was again part of his virtuous nature.
Yes.
Is that. Boy, if George Washington believed something, I mean, he stood up for it. Now, the thing is that what a lot of people may not know about that whiskey tax, that was put in effect at the time of the Revolution to make sure they had an army to protect them. And so it was not just a fly-by-night thing. It was there to really protect everybody. And it is something that when you are a strong leader and a tough leader, sometimes you know, things don't go as you expect, and not everybody necessarily agrees. Well, it looks like we're out of time for today's program as well, and so we'll continue this discussion next time, and then after that I'll have some concluding remarks about George Washington. And remember, our third and final book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can also find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.